Welcome to Book Hype. I'm Jen, and today I'm joined by Kristen, Karen, and Brittany. Hey guys, how's it going?
Hi.
Pretty good. Hi.
Hello. I'm very tired of the sun.
I think so. I'm not so much tired of the sun as I am the heat, because up here it's been, like, horrible. Like, the heat index has been over 100 for the last, like, 4 days. Like, it's not okay. It's just not. So how have you guys been, other than melting in the heat? Kristen and Karen, how are you guys doing?
Pretty good. Yeah. We're watching West Wing now, and I'm very excited that Karen's watching West Wing.
Oh, thank God.
So,
have you never watched it before, Karen?
No.
Oh.
It's, we're literally only on episode 4. We haven't even finished episode 4. We had to pause it so we could come do Book Hype, and I'm like, in love already. I need to get everyone's names right.
And the next episode is the crackpots and those women. And I'm very excited because it's such a good one. And I'm like, yes. So, well, yeah, it's exciting around here.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you guys have that. Who doesn't like a little binge watching of anything at this point in time? All right. So let's talk about what we've been reading. Clearly we know what you've been watching, ladies. But Karen, what have you been reading?
Well, I picked up a series by Elle Kennedy, and I read the first two, The Deal and then The Mistake. And The Deal, I literally wanted to give it 6 stars on Goodreads because it was that good. It was amazing and perfect. And my favorite thing about it was she had like 3 or 4 different opportunities to use this like miscommunication trope, and then she just cut it off before it could get too far. And that's one of the things I hate the most, is like the miscommunication trope. And she just works her way around it. And I was just really appreciative of that. And it was just a good story overall. The Mistake I liked less. I think that it was a little slow in the middle, but I did like the beginning and the end of it. But they were both really good. She's a fantastic author and so funny. I know we were talking about Alice Clayton before being really funny, but Elle Kennedy, like, I snorted. It was really embarrassing, but I was reading along being totally fine, and I laughed so hard I snorted. So
remind me, who's in The Deal? Because I've read all of these books, but I confuse them often with Serena Bowen, so I want to make sure I have the right set of characters.
The Deal is Garrett and and Hannah, right?
Hannah, right. Yeah. And then The Mistake is
Grace.
And
Logan.
Logan, thank you. Okay,
read it and I already
picked it up. No, well, that's the thing. I get them confused. And then the last one is Hannah's friend.
Yes.
And then the last roommate. Well, not the third to last roommate, because there's still one more. Tucker is the last one, right? That we're waiting on. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. Good. See, I knew I would remember once I like got the names, because I'm like, wait a minute. I frequently confuse them with the others that I've read because they're all a little similar in that they're sports guys and there's different, but they're all still equally unique and fantastic. So I'm glad you like those, Karen. Those were a good series.
And I finally got my library card, so that's cool. So I'll probably be burning through these a lot faster because it won't be as expensive picking up like 10 at a time. So that'll be really nice. And the last thing I read this week was Hotel Valhalla, Guide to the Norse Worlds by Rick Riordan. And
she's not at all excited. No,
there was no pitch change there at all. I felt nothing.
God, I'm sorry. I'm such an embarrassment to you guys.
It's horrible. I love it.
No, but this is a little companion novel to the Magnus Chase series. And it's not written by Magnus like the coffee table books are written in the voice of Percy Jackson. This is actually like a book that they quote unquote put in the drawers in Hotel Valhalla. So when you die and you go there, you can read it and kind of learn like how the hotel works and the worlds. And so you can get used to like the mythology and everything. And it's quite funny. I mean, pretty typical Rick Riordan, but it's also really dynamic because not only does it give you like a peek at some of the gods and their stories, but it also has like games in there. And there's a rap battle between the sword and one of the gods, and like, it's just, it's so ridiculous, and yet it works. It works perfectly, like all of his books do. So I had a lot of fun reading that. It's super short, very quick read, and it places a few hints for the second book as well. Nothing that we didn't already know about, because the second book is called The Hammer of Thor, but it teases that, yes, Thor's hammer is missing, and what are we going to do to find it? So I thought that was kind of cool.
Awesome. I like it. All right, Kristen, what have you been up to? I see you've read one of my favorite books ever.
Yes. We'll get there. No, the first one I read this week was Show Me How by Molly McAdams. It actually comes out on Tuesday. It's the last book in the Thatch series, and I've loved this series. It's only 3 books long, but she wrote the first book like 2 years ago and then took a year and a half to write the second book, and now we only had to wait like 3 months for the third one, thank goodness. But I love this series a lot. It's not like super cutesy funny. It's really serious and intense, but it's so, so well done. Show Me How is about, like, it's the younger sibling of one of the main characters from the first book, and one of their, like, best friends who's basically a giant man whore, and how, like, he makes a lot of changes in his life, and he just doesn't really know why, and it's really beautiful. Like, it's really, really well done. I loved it so, so much, and I can't wait for people to get their hands on it this week. The second one I read was Beautiful Secret by Christina Loren, which apparently Jen is quite fond of.
I'm fond of Max. Let's just be straightforward about this whole situation. Sonia and I have had many a talk about the males from Christina Loren's books, and Sonia's under the impression that I only like the British guys, which isn't very far off, but Max is one of my favorites. I don't know, I really like him.
Well, wait, Max is the younger one, right? Niall?
Yes. Oh, wait, is it Niall?
Niall.
The Beautiful Secret Niall? Did I mix them up? Oh, yeah. No, Niall is like my all-time favorite. Is it Beautiful? What is Max's book? Beautiful?
Max's Beautiful Stranger?
Yes. Sorry. Yes. Beautiful. No.
It's okay.
Niall is my absolute favorite because he's so different from all the other alpha males in their, like, stories. So I like Niall because he's not like the rest of them, and he's very sweet.
Yes. I quite enjoyed it, I will say, but Niall is not my favorite. I like some alpha male, apparently. I'm a Max fan.
Well, okay. Well, see, then you're okay. We're still okay. It's
fine. I really loved Max's story. It's really different from some of the stuff I've read before. Like, just that whole story is kind of crazy, but really good fun. But no, I really liked this one because it's also kind of different in that he is this divorcee who's only been with one person his entire life and just kind of realized that they weren't right for each other. And it's really, really, it's really beautiful. But I really enjoyed this series quite a bit. And I'm now kind of super excited to be right in line to read the final book with everybody else.
Yes.
Even though it took me forever to get to the series, now I'm like all caught up, ready to go.
I don't know how you never read this series, because I feel like these authors are like perfection for you. Like, I feel like they give you what you really like, Kristen. So that's why I was so surprised when you had never read them before. I'm like, what?
Well, I was waiting on my library to get the audiobooks because that's how I get a lot of my reading done. So,
and these audiobooks, the people who read these audiobooks,
they're fabulous. I love them.
I have both Max and Niall's book in audio form. I love them.
I think I have Will's book, I think is the one I bought. So yeah. I will be buying Max because I really liked Will too. But I will be
there
buying.
Are some the accents and everything are just fantastic in that book. I'm just gonna say, throw it out there. Yeah. Really like it.
And,
anyway, moving
and
on.
I have read The Wild Seasons as well, except for the final one, because I've been waiting on that one to show up at my library. But it's now there. I just have to. I'm on the hold list, so we'll get there.
Oh my goodness! These library things, I can't handle it.
But I also picked up a series by Lex Martin. I forget what the series name is. Of course, it doesn't have it on the cover of the book, of the ebook. But it's Dearest Clementine, Finding Dandelion, and Kissing Madeline. It's new adult. It's set in a college atmosphere. At least the first two are. The third one is about a character that you meet in the first two and that it has grown up a bit by the time you get to his book, but they were really, really good fun. Not the best books I've ever read, but just really fun, interesting, unique stories. Clementine is an author in her book. Like, she's in college, but her freshman year of college writes this YA not so happy story, and it becomes a bestseller, and it's the only way she can afford to be in college. And then, like, you kind of find out why her life has been so difficult, and you find out that her book is like an autobiography almost, but she made it fiction by changing a few little things, and how that kind of becomes an issue with everybody in her life, and how all of them, you know, she writes under a pen name, so not everybody knows it's hers, and it's really interesting. Finding Dandelion is kind of centered around her brother, which was interesting to start the series from a female point of view and like step into the male point of view was different. But you also get her roommate Danny's point of view in that one too, so it's good fun. But yeah, I really quite enjoyed them. So if you're looking for something a little like lighthearted and not terribly difficult to read, definitely try them. Pick them up; they're good.
Awesome. And Brittany, what have you been up to?
I did start Brittany Cavallaro's second sequel or second book in the Study in Charlotte series. I forgot that I had started it, but it was so good, and I was reading it at breakfast, and there was like a big rush at the breakfast place I was at, and I'm like, if I don't leave this spot, they're gonna get mad at me. And then I got busy and forgot about it, and I was reading selections from Neil Gaiman's A View from the Cheap Seats, which is a collection of stuff that's been published or out in the world before, some speeches, some like forwards to books that he wrote, and it's really good and really well edited, and it's divided into sections, but I like that you can just like flip to anything and read it, and it's all very inspirational, and I really like reading things when people are like, this person is doing a good job, and I am going to tell them why they're doing a good job or why humanity is good. And it's been very uplifting, especially because, as we're going to get to, the book I picked to read for this special turned out to be a very intense abortion book. So I was like, okay, I need something to balance this book out. And it was Neil Gaiman.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm good. Are you liking the second book so far in the Charlotte Holmes series?
Oh, yeah, it's great. And I'm really glad that I remembered that I was reading it, because that's what I'm going to do tonight. I'm probably going to
I haven't started it yet, because I'm like, I probably am going to want to read it in one sitting. So I'm trying to like etch out the time so that I can do it, because I'm like, I really need it. I discovered the other day that there were a lot of the second novels in the Sherlock Holmes series that Brittany and I have been reading available. So I hurried up and grabbed a bunch of them, because I also got Mind Games by Heather Petty, which is the second novel in the, I'm not going to remember the first, Locke and Morrie, the Locke and Morrie series. So I'm really excited about that one too. And I have them, they're sitting there and they're taunting me. Because I'm like, those you have to like read, like, and you have to have the time to read them, because otherwise you might miss something. So anyway, so for me, I read Beautiful, which is the last book by Christina Loren in the Beautiful series. It features Jensen, who is Hannah's brother, and Pippa, who we met in Beautiful Secret, and that's Ruby's friend from London. And I have to say, in this book, you can tell that they're trying to like make sure everyone gets, you know, a glimpse at the people that are, that started the series and that have been the core couples throughout the series. This trip features a road trip, and so we get a lot of Ruby and Niall, as well as Hannah and Will, and Jensen and Pippa, who just meet for the first time. And they have the most awkward meet-cute ever, and it's fantastic. There are some things about Jensen that I don't think we knew before that come up in this novel, and that make it really interesting as the novel progresses. I think they did a great job. I think it's a really nice kind of cap to the series that has, you know, been their lives for the last, 5 years at least. I'm sad to see all these characters kind of be done, but at the same time, I can't wait to see what else they come out with. So I really enjoyed Beautiful. That comes out, I think, in October. And sometime in September, I think we will have a sneak peek for the readers of Pipeable. It will be on the site. It will be one of the chapters from the book. And then I started reading Rookie Mistake by Tracy Ward. It's like a sports romance-y novel. It's really fun. It's sassy. I really, really enjoyed it. But that's all I've had time to do for reading this week. I've been very slackish. It's not been good. But yeah, so that's it. Kristen, have you read Rookie Mistake? Is that one of the ones that you've mentioned before?
No, but that's the title of Serena Bowen's upcoming one.
I was like, why does it sound so familiar when I picked up to read it? But again, Kristen, I think it's one you would like. It's a very sporty, like, the girl in it is Sloane. She's a sports agent, and the guy is a quarterback fresh out of college. And he's going into the NFL draft, and she's kind of, like, helping him. But at the same time, he's not technically her client. It's this whole thing. But it's really enjoyable. So it's definitely – and there are a bunch of companion novels that go with it. So I definitely think it would be something you would like.
Very cool. By the way, I am so glad that Beautiful is Pippa's story because I love her. And yes.
Yeah. Like, Pippa is a sassafras and a half in this novel. and if you guys remember Jensen, you met him briefly in Will and Hannah's novels and the novella. Jensen's a little more uptight. He's a little more regimented. But there's a very big reason for that that I don't think is revealed that I remember. Because I remember being surprised when it came up in this novel. So I think when it all comes out, you're like, oh. And it's a really interesting dynamic between the two of them. It's enjoyable. And I'm telling you, the way they meet is so fantastic. And really funny. And so, yeah. So I think you guys will like it. It's definitely enjoyable. I know Sonia is like, I need it. I need it right now.
Give it to me. Yes, I know that feeling.
There's a lot of grabby hand action on her part. All right, so we're just talking about companion novels. So let's talk about some of the best companion novels as our Book Bites item. Some of the best companion novels that have come out recently or that we have come across that we really like. Now, I know, I think it was Karen who listed a bunch of companion novels that she's aware of, but I thought of companion novels a little bit differently, so we can talk about that, too. So, Karen, why don't you go ahead and talk about the ones that you mentioned, for example?
Yeah, there are two, and actually, Kristen and I discussed this, too, when I was coming up with this idea, because I thought about it one way first, and then she was like, oh, I kind of thought about it this way, and I realized, yeah, it kind of can be, you know, two different types of companion novels. So the kind that I was thinking of originally was, like I was talking about with Hotel Valhalla, something that isn't necessarily, like, another addition to the series, but is literally a companion novel in that it goes with the series, it's in the same world, and I'm thinking like, you know, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Beetle the Bard, Quidditch Through the Ages, that sort of thing. Even something like The Short Second Life of Bree Tanner, which was a little spin-off like novella, but obviously there are other ways you could think about that as well.
Right, and so the way I thought about it was that like these novels, oftentimes we read different series and things, and the novels are connected, but you could pick up a novel and read it on your own and not be confused. So I thought of those as companion novels. So something like Anna and the French Kiss and Lola and the Boy Next Door and Isla and the Happily Ever After, because you could pick up any one of those novels and read them completely independently. But they still have some of those characters that are connected within it that you really enjoy and you get to get glimpses of. So even like the Beautiful series is really a set of companion novels. It's not necessarily like it's a series, but you could pick it up and read them in any order. It doesn't really particularly matter.
And a lot of romance novels just work like that to begin with. You know, they take a character and then they tell their story. I don't know about you guys. I still can't read them out of order. I have to read them in order.
It's nice to read them in order. Like, I get why you want to read them in order, because you don't want to, like, you always know the couple's going to get together. Like, it's almost a given. But at the same time, you want to enjoy how they get there. So, I mean, I get it. But, yeah. So, that's all I was thinking of it.
I was going to say, and in addition to both of those, I've, like, in the romance world, there's a lot of times they'll tell like the major story in the series, and then there's also novellas that are a part of the series that are short little like interludes in between books. Right. Like the Beautiful series has quite a few of them where like the boys are going to have their bachelor party for one of the guys, and so they take you outside of their normal surroundings, put them in a new place, and tell you a quick little, you know, 100-page story about these characters that you already love. That can kind of be a companion novel too. So there's a lot of ways to think about it,
I guess. Yeah. So, but I think, I don't know. I don't know if I have a best. I mean, I just enjoy looking at all of them. I have to admit, I haven't read Hotel Valhalla yet, but it sounds super cute and funny, and I really liked that book. So I like the Magnus Chase book, so I will probably look into that one. And then I think it was really interesting when we got the Fantastic Beasts and the Quidditch Through the Ages, and they kind of came out like as the school books that we were learning about in the Harry Potter novel. So I thought those were really cool too, because it added a different layer to it. I mean, and obviously Fantastic Beasts has totally become its own thing right now. So I don't know. I enjoy anything that gives me any information that I didn't previously have that doesn't have to be its own like separate book. So any of the ones like you described originally, Karen, I do enjoy those for a different reason than I do the way the books that are only slightly connected through, you know, the occasional character popping up or whatever. Do you guys have any other thoughts? Brittany, do you have any thoughts on companion novels, or if you have a favorite?
I don't like companion novels. but I am interested to see how you guys thought of what constitutes a companion novel, because I was under this, and the first thing that Karen said, like, that's my thinking, like, the Hotel Valhalla and Fantastic Beasts and things that are like kind of almost like spin-offy, but they won't affect anything that's like going on in your series. And but when you were talking about like Anna and the French Kiss and Isla and Lola, it made me think of Sarah Dessen's series, because some of those characters pop up in other books, but they're very independent of each other, and it doesn't really reveal anything too much if you read them out of order. So that's interesting. Those are like companion characters, I would describe them as, I think. But I have read Beetle and the Bard, which I thought was really cute because that was like a storybook type of thing, whereas Quidditch the Ages, I own all of them. I bought them all like together in like a, you know, one of those little box set things. But that one is one I just sort of like flipped through, and Fantastic Beasts, same thing. Just sort of like I have it, but I don't think it's going to be a big help to really read it before the movie comes out. The same thing with like Pottermore stuff. I feel like Pottermore is very much a companion novel in and of itself, even though they're going to now be technically novels, like the ebooks that are coming out. That stuff I won't read because I don't read anything that's on Pottermore now. So I don't know if I would pick up stuff like that. I kind of like the self-contained world, unless it's something I'm like really, really interested in. So like I read that four novel that came with the Divergent series.
Oh yeah, yep.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. Just because they were quick. They were almost like the whole book was like comprised of like little novellas because it like spanned a large time period over the course of the series. So that was kind of cool. And you got a little bit of background about four, but normally they're not things that I will go for and actively look into. Because if I didn't do it for Harry Potter, I don't think that there's another series out there that's going to make me want to pick up a companion novel.
Good point. All right. So let's move on to our main topic of discussion for this episode, which is Michael Crichton. You guys may know him as the author of Jurassic Park, The Andromeda Strain, Timeline, Disclosure, and any many other numerous books. He was also wrote television. He wrote and basically created ER, which I didn't realize until we started looking into things, and I was really surprised, I guess, that it was ER was his. I don't know why. I don't know. I thought it was someone else's, but it was his. And so he's done a lot of amazing things. In his lifetime, he So just quickly to review Michael Crichton, he was born in 1942. He did a lot of different things throughout his life. He was a trained physician. He was a writer, obviously. He directed, he wrote screenplays, and he developed things for TV. He produced a lot of his books into movies. So there was, he had a lot going on. He was also, I believe he was also a professor, if I remember correctly. So he passed away in 2008 at age 66. He was an American bestselling author, and he was best known for his work in science fiction and medical fiction and the thriller genres. All right, so I don't think any of us have actually read a Michael Crichton book, have we? Or you guys started?
Yeah, we did for this episode.
You did for this. Okay, I wasn't sure if you guys actually got through them, so I wanted to make sure.
Yes, just checking. I did.
You're just joking. But prior to that, none of us had actually read a Michael Crichton novel, which seems really weird.
I know.
But I think in the end, if you look when his novels had come out and when they were popular, it wouldn't have necessarily been things that we were reading at the time, like age-wise. They don't necessarily fit into the ages that we were at the time. Like, legitimately, his novels came out in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. Mm-hmm. So, but we all have seen his movies to some extent. So some of his best known works are Jurassic Park and Jurassic World and those adaptations, The Andromeda Strain and State of Fear. And then next was his last book before death. Until recently, as we reported last week, there is a new novel, Dragon's Teeth, if I remember correctly, that will be coming out. His wife was cleaning out some things and discovered it in one of his folders on his computer. So she has turned it in, and they were going to be releasing it in 2017.
And I didn't know this, but this has happened before, because two other books came out after he had died, too.
Yeah.
Latitudes and Micro.
Right. Did she find them, or were they known entities that were there and just...
I think Pirate Latitudes he had been working on.
Right.
Kristen, you know a little bit more about the story behind Micro, right?
Not really, but I'm imagining that was probably something he had mostly written and was in edit, like at the editor or whatever when he passed. Like I only made it about halfway through that because of, you know, difficulties with technology, but it felt very much like something he would write. Like, it didn't feel like somebody else had a hand in it. So I had imagined that it was almost complete, and like revisions maybe were done by somebody else.
Okay, well, that's really good. And that's the same thing. Dragon's Teeth is complete. It hasn't been edited or revised, but it was a complete novel when it was discovered. So it'll be really interesting to see what that feels like to a reader who's read Michael Crichton for, you know, most of his other works. And his works are so vast. Like, you have things like Jurassic Park, which clearly is going to appeal to kind of like a very particular audience. And then you have something like Disclosure, which is something completely different. For those of you that are not familiar with Disclosure, it is about the corporate world, really. It's about a man who goes in and takes a position at a company. His ex-lover works there, and she gets the promotion over him, and she's, like, set out to destroy him. And she's in the position of power, and the man is not, which is a very unusual thing for the time period I think it was written in. Because it was written in, like, the very late 80s, early 1990s, and it's usually a role reversal. It's usually the female who's put in that position, not the male. So it's a really interesting story, and it was also turned into a movie. So, again, I think it's a really interesting thing for people to check out and read about, and, again, giving the time period, looking at how it's structured. So, basically, Michael Crichton leaves this very large legacy behind him. He became the only creative artist ever to have works simultaneously charting number one on U.S. television, film, and a book series. So his U.S. television series, obviously, was ER. The film was Jurassic Park, and the book was Disclosure. There were some questions, too. I don't know, when you guys were reading in, like, researching about him, a couple of articles made note that he had problems with xenophobia.
Yeah.
Now, when you guys saw those articles, did you check the dates on them?
No. I don't think so.
Because the articles that I found that started to talk about this sort of thing were much more recent than the time period than when these books and movies and things were made and created. So I wonder.
I think that makes sense, though.
Right. It's sort of an observation. Because I think if you go back and you look at the types of things that were being made in the late 80s and early 90s, you're going to have xenophobia as an issue with most of the material. Like, if you think of the Die Hard movies, if you think of, what was it? I can't think of the name of the other movies I was talking about. It begins with a P, and I can't remember it. But there were a lot of action-y type movies where the bad guys were from a different country, and they were going to come and take over, and it was a lot of that whole idea behind it. It's not very different from the things that I think we see in TVs and movies today, where the bad guys are now of a specific background that, we fight wars against and all these different things. So I feel like a little bit of it is the time period in which he lived and the things that he saw. It's not justifying in any way, but if you go back and look at the material from that period as a whole, I think it's all very similar.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was specifically looking into Rising Sun because Kristen and I tried to watch the movie and Netflix just wouldn't let us do it. But I was looking into it because within the first, even just looking at the picture, I was like, this seems questionable for the movie. I wonder what the book is like. And I found this article, and I'm sure that it was, like you were saying, more of a recent article. But I think that's interesting and a good perspective to keep in mind, because I know going into this episode, I kind of put Michael Crichton up on a pedestal because I think, even having never read any of his books, I knew how important he was for his time and for the genres that he wrote for. But it's also kind of nice to know, okay, he wasn't perfect. It's not like he was this incredible author that never did anything wrong. Yes, there are issues with some of the things he's written. And while that might be a product of the time, I also think it's important to recognize that and then talk about it, because I would like to think today we are better. Maybe not perfect, definitely not perfect, but because I think we still have a lot of those issues. But I think it's nice to be able to look back and be like, okay, this wasn't questioned back then because that was sort of the norm, but we're questioning it now, and that means that we are more aware of those issues.
I think people can be aware, but I don't think they're actually different in storytelling. Like, if you look at the movies and the novels and things that are being written about now, the faces are different. It's not the Russians anymore. It's not the Japanese. It's now anyone from the Middle East. Those are the people that we see. Do you know what I mean? So, yes, it's different, but I can't say that it's actually changed that much. It's just the face of the people that we're calling the bad guys or the villains is different. You know, they're not from Russia anymore or the USSR, which is, that was for a very long time. That was the biggest people used against the United States. That was always the villain in any really big action movie or novel. And now it's changed. Now it's the Middle East and it's terrorism. And it looks a little different, but the problem's still there, I think, when it comes to creating a villain in our stories.
Yeah, definitely.
Kristen or Brittany, do you guys have any thoughts about that?
I mean, nothing that you guys didn't already say. Like, it's important, even after an author passes or after, like, their influence, their time of influence has kind of moved on. It's important to kind of look back and see how they saw the world and what was going on in the world and how we can, think differently or how we can learn from that. So yeah, maybe he did have some issues with it, but it's good to be aware of that. If anything, like, it just makes you a more realized person to see where other people have had, issues in the past. And it just helps make you a more well-rounded individual. So yeah, I mean, like, it's, it, nobody's perfect. So, you know, there's bound to be something that when you look back on someone's life and their, you know, life's work, there's bound to be something that someone finds that, you know, is troubling or whatever, but, you know, it's just a part of being human and all that.
Yeah. And the book that I picked, for this episode, he's very liberal and has a lot of, ideas about the world that are not widely accepted. And so I think that for him to write, this book was published in like the 60s, late 60s, 68, I think. And it's for thinking about it in the context of the time that he wrote it and published it, it's very interesting. And he kind of like, he doesn't attack any group. He doesn't say any group's wrong. But he also like is heavily, like he gets his point across as to what he believes and who's in the right and how things work in the city of Boston at this time period. And it was really interesting, to read this and then come into the doc and see like, oh, but maybe he wasn't actually as open-minded and liberal as you would think. 'Cause I, did not know anything about the xenophobia stuff. So yeah, that's interesting to hear coming out of reading this.
All right, so let's move on, because we each picked a book to kind of read and talk a little bit about, because it was our first kind of experience reading. So Brittany, do you want to start? You kind of just talked a little bit about it. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the book that you read?
Yeah, so I read A Case of Need, and he was writing as Jeffrey Hudson when he wrote this book. He wrote a lot of medical books when he just got out of his residency, I think it was. And so this was like, it's more like of an ethical book. It is about abortion and how this one doctor gets called in because a woman died after having an abortion that was botched, and they're blaming him for doing it when he didn't do it. And so it takes place over 3 days. It's 3 days in October from the time the doctor is arrested until they're about to charge him. And what happens is it happens to be the daughter of one of like the prominent doctors in Boston. And so they kind of like know that this guy has been giving abortion was illegal in Boston when this was written. And so this doctor has been giving abortions, but writing them off as like bad, like everything was presenting normal. None of the people who got abortions tested positive for pregnancy. So they were fudging the tissue samples. Like they would, if they had a patient come in who was not pregnant, they would take extra of those tissue samples and use them in the case files of the people that they did provide abortions to. And he wouldn't do abortions on anyone over 3 months pregnant. So this woman happened to be 4 months pregnant, and she bled out, like she hemorrhaged a few days later. And it's like this whole thing, and how a lot of doctors ended up being covering for one another. And so it's like this whole chain of things, but then they're dealing with the Irish Catholic cops. And so it doesn't matter if he didn't do it or not. He had done it. They need a scapegoat. And chances are, because everything's happening in Boston, that 6 out of your 12 jurors are going to be from Irish Catholic families. And they're just going to be like, nope, this is an abortion case. I know which way I'm voting, regardless of what he did or did not do. So it was really, really interesting to watch it unfold. And it, I picked this book primarily because I'm obsessed with ER. I love ER. And I was like, oh, good, I'll read a medical novel. And it turned out to be something completely different, which is how ER is. And I can see the roots of ER in this so much. He is so good at characters interacting with one another and like explaining facts, but not pounding you over the head with them. Like, this book had a ton of footnotes and an appendix, like, so you can get as much medical information as you want. You don't have to read it, but he's willing to give you everything. So they had to do an autopsy, and I can probably do an autopsy because it is so detailed, and like, just, it reads like a medical journal, but it's entertaining at the same time. Like, none of it felt like dry or too gross or anything, and it was really good and very suspenseful, I will say, and you just wanted to watch it unfold, and it was only 3 days. Like, I had to keep reminding myself, I'm like, this is all in one day. Like, this whole, like, 250 pages was in one day, and all of this happened from, like, 7 in the morning until midnight that night, and it was really, really good.
That's crazy, because it does, if you stop, like, I read a lot about what he had to say about ER, because ER was actually something that he had written in the 70s, and it didn't come into fruition until the 90s, and so clearly this book came before that, like, kind of in the middle of it all. But, like, if you think about how ER was, like, think about the episodes you may have seen on TV and how quick it was, and how, I don't, it was just so different from the other things that were on TV at the time. So it's really cool that that book kind of translates that, and, like, you can see how ER existed for him in any aspect of his medical writing, which is really cool.
Yeah, because this was published in 68, and he was writing. His medical writing was all happening at the time he was developing ER. So,
got it.
Yeah, so, exactly. You can really see how his writing translates into dramatic television, because it does provide the facts. It does go into detail, but as much detail as, say, like, a West Wing explains, like, a fake conflict that's going on and what, you know, history or Congress, like, it explains what Congress has to do, but it doesn't beat you over the head with it. It's just like, here's a really quick reminder as to how a bill is voted on, but also I'm going to be walking around an office and going crazy like Josh Lyman and while explaining it. So it's like, you know, you can really see that in this book as to how well this type of dramatic writing would translate to television, which was kind of really interesting to, like, you know, do the reverse. Instead of reading something and then watching something, I had already watched a lot and then read this, and you can just see the roots of it. So it was kind of cool.
That's really awesome. All right, so let's see. Karen, what did you read?
I picked up The Andromeda Strain for this episode of ours, and the reason why I chose this one is because it's my dad's favorite Michael Crichton book, so I was like, oh, well, this will be a good place to start, and I can call him up when I'm finished and tell him that I read it, and he'll be all proud of me and stuff. But technically, this one is a techno-thriller, and it is set in Arizona. He wrote this in 1969, and it's about these scientists who investigate the outbreak of an extraterrestrial microorganism that presents itself as, like, you know, a disease that's spreading around. And it basically, within the opening chapter of the book, this town, this really small town in Arizona, there's only like 50 people who live there. They all died. Their bodies are just strewn across the town, and they're all dead, and they're trying to figure out what happened. And I feel like I'm coming at this from a different angle than Brittany, because you're right, like, the way he writes is so scientific, and it lends itself to this insane realism where you're like, okay, clearly, like, I couldn't tell you the difference between something that he kind of fudged for the story to make it interesting versus, like, real science that he did research on. And I know that he's known for extensive research when it comes to his books, but everything feels so real. And I think that's really good to make the story visceral. But at the same time, I had so much trouble getting through the first, like, 50 or 60 pages of the book, because it was all like, okay, let's introduce this character and let's spend 3 pages talking about this essay he wrote back in college and why he's known for this. And, like, yeah, that'll kind of come into play because then you know his speciality. But for me, it was just a lot of, like, information dumps. And I found myself getting bored with it and not really wanting to read the book. But as I kept reading and they kind of got past, like, the whole building of the team part, and we got into them going to the crime scene and checking it out, I found myself really drawn in, because now I kind of knew why what they were doing was important, and he was explaining the science behind it all and what they could and couldn't do, and the mysteries are set up. They're so excellent, and it really draws you in, but I don't know about you guys, but I definitely had trouble getting through that initial, like, info dump with all the science.
Well, I'm a science girl, so the science part doesn't always bother me so much.
See, but I am too. I love science. I thought that was the field that I was going to end up going in everything, but it's something about just, it just feels very dry to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just me.
It may have just been that book too, because each book I think is different. And as he progressed more out of the really science heavy stuff into the more like fantasy and science combos, that might have a different effect on the writing as well.
True.
So that could be part of it. Kristen, what did you choose?
I read Micro, which was actually published posthumously for him. And it's very, I had some of the same problems Karen had in that the beginning of the story, it takes a while to kind of figure out where it's going, like how we're getting there. But as I was reading it, like it kind of sets itself up like the third Jurassic Park movie does, in that the first, like the beginning of this book, this event happens. Like, you know how in the beginning of Jurassic Park 3, this kid and his dad are going parasailing, and then all of a sudden, the people in the boat underneath them have been eaten. And we know what happened. Like, you can see what happened, but they have no idea, really. And that's kind of how Micro starts, is that you see this private detective that basically has nothing else to do with the story go out to this science research facility in Hawaii, in like an area of the island that is not used readily, like it's not developed commercially or anything like that. And he goes out to this lab facility to investigate something for a client. And by the time, like, what he sees there is insane, and he leaves to go fill in his client, and when he gets there, they're all killed. And it's like, that's how the novel starts. You don't get any of the, like, big fancy introduction. You get this event. And then you meet your lead, and you find out exactly what's going on with the lead and his, you know, ragtag group of friends who are all going to end up in this story and be the heart of the story. And it just, I don't know. I liked Micro so far, due to technical difficulties, AKA my Kindle not downloading the two middle parts of the audiobook. I could only get about halfway before I had to stop. I really am liking it. The story is basically about a science lab that's doing research into what to say without giving away everything. They're doing research into like using an extreme magnetic field to shrink living matter. And you see quickly, you find out how successful they've been and what that means for, like, people and all of that. And in the midst of all of this, you have the head of this science lab doing some pretty nefarious, awful things in order to keep their research a secret and to stay in control of the story. So your main characters end up, the title kind of gives it away. The main characters end up being shrunk down, and then it becomes almost like a Jurassic Parkian kind of adventure, because they're in this world full of animals that they know, like creatures that they know because they're scientists, but they are seeing them in a whole new light, and they don't know, you know, they have to try and survive and find their way out. And it was really cool. The part where I left the story was like incredibly like crazy and tragic. The event that happened right before I found out I couldn't listen to anymore. And so I'm kind of dying to get back to it and find out what happens after that moment. But it's really good, especially for people who like Jurassic Park and all that. It reads very much that way.
All right. Awesome. So my book that I read was Timeline. And the reason I chose this specific one from him is because it kind of brings all the things I like together. Timeline is about time travel, obviously, in case you didn't pick that up from the title. And it's about these archaeologists who are on a dig, and they discover that their professor is missing. But as they're digging in the, like, on the site, they discover his eyeglasses and a message written to them in proper English. And the site that they're digging at is actually, like, from medieval times, so it shouldn't be written that way. So they head back to this company who's funding them, and they say, well, you know, we sent him back in time. He's now stuck there. You all need to go back and get him. So this group of young archaeologists travel back in time to find, like, this professor. And when they do, they land in medieval times, and there are knights and horsemen, and all of these things are happening. And they have to try to help this one lord who's under siege from a different lord. And you find out that the bad guy, essentially, was actually an employee from this original company, this ITC, and he had traveled back in time. But because he had traveled so many times, he kind of went a little bit mad. So he stayed back in the medieval times, basically so he could rule. And it kind of spins out from there and how these people have to kind of navigate this time period and get their leader back, their professor back, his last name is Johnston, and get back to, you know, our time period. And it's really cool because I like time travel, and B, I like historical things that are set in really cool historical periods like this. So this one was a really cool novel to read. It was a lot of fun. And again, it's very detailed. And I like a lot of detail when I read things like this, because I don't particularly like learning about history from a history book. But if I can read about it in a way that's fun, then I'm all about learning it, which is probably really strange. But just to read it in a history book is kind of dry for me, but to have it kind of incorporated in some sort of adventure novel works way better. I really like this novel. It was also made into a film starring Paul Walker and Gerard Butler, actually. And it wasn't as, the film was not nearly as good as the book, but it was still good. I mean, it's still an enjoyable kind of adventure tale, so. And I just really, I like the tone of it. I like the way it kind of just looked at the world and how, you know, these things were possible. Because I think when this was written, it was there wasn't this huge thing with Doctor Who and all these other things that are very time traveler-esque these days. I mean, clearly Doctor Who has been around for ages, but it wasn't like a prominent point during, you know, like it is now with Doctor Who. So I think it was really cool to see how they would play the time travel angle and how it worked. So, yeah. All right. So let's talk about movie adaptations. I think lots and lots of people have seen some form of Jurassic Park, or more recently, Jurassic World. Would that be a fair assumption?
I believe
yes.
So.
Yes.
We've all seen it. Raise your hands. That was probably one of the more classic adaptations of his novels. How can you ever forget seeing dinosaurs like that? Do you know what I mean? Like, it was one of the coolest things ever. Did anyone see the Andromeda Strain? Did you guys get to watch it or no?
I didn't either.
And then Sphere, Karen and Kristen, you watched it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. Sphere came out right around the same time as Contact, which a lot of people will recognize with Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey before he was the all right guy. I loved Sphere back in the day when I first saw it. I didn't know it was a Michael Crichton novel. It's an insane film. It's kind of in the same realm as Contact. Like, it's about humans kind of stumbling across some sort of contact from aliens. In this case, it's a ship that's crash landed at the bottom of the ocean and that has been there for so long that coral has started to grow over it. And so they realize the ship has been there for like 200 years. And so they send this team down to investigate it and to, you know, hopefully make contact with hopefully some surviving extraterrestrial creature. They send like a mathematician, a psychologist, a biologist, like they send a whole team with everyone who could possibly be useful in contacting them. And you see that this team discovers this artifact, you could kind of say, artifact/being, that is basically a like sphere whose surface is metallic and reflective. And from there, the movie is just insane because, you know, you find out how their contact with the sphere like affects them and what it does. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's a really interesting sci-fi alien kind of movie. If you're at all interested in that genre, I say give it a shot. You may not have been aware of it, but it stars Dustin Hoffman, Sharon Stone, Samuel L. Jackson. Like it's really good fun.
Yeah. I, you know, and even watching it today, like I really enjoyed it. The graphics aren't like too bad. I think a lot of it was, you know, studios and like based in not like really bad 80s or 90s graphics. So that part didn't take me out of it at all. It's a good movie and it completely blows your mind. Like afterward, I was just like, I didn't get all the answers that I wanted, but I kind of don't care because it was just, it makes you think, and I love those kind of movies. But I was asking people on Twitter, you know, which adaptations of Michael Crichton's books, other than, you know, Jurassic Park, obviously, have you guys watched, and like which ones are the most popular? I kind of wanted to dive into one or two of them, and I had several people come to me and say Congo and Sphere. And because Kristen was already a fan, we decided to watch Sphere, and I definitely don't regret it. It was a really good movie.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about Congo, because Congo is a definitely a different sort of novel. It's more along the lines of Jurassic Park in a sense, because you have the villains are creatures, really. They're not people, I guess, maybe, depends on how you look at it. So Congo is about a group of people going to the Congo, the rainforest, and looking for diamonds. And one team, the first team that goes is murdered. And the only thing that they get back via satellite is an image of a gray-haired gorilla. So a second team goes down again to look for the diamonds and to discover what happened to the other team. And they come across this kind of almost mutant form of gorilla that is living in the Congo. So do you guys know anything else about it? Have you seen it at all? Have you been interested in it at all?
No. We tried to get our hands on a copy, but it was proving difficult. And I was really excited about Karen seeing Sphere, so we got a little distracted. But I do want to see it. Like, it's one of those that I think I've kind of always known about but never had the time to watch or never went digging for. So I definitely want to check it out sometime in the near future.
Yeah, I think it'll be, it's an interesting, I've seen part of it like ages and ages ago. I don't know if I've watched the whole thing, but yeah. All right, so have you guys seen any other films or movie adaptations of his novels?
No.
Definitely check out Timeline. Karen, I have a feeling you would actually like it, even though it's not, like, compared to the book, it's not exactly what it should be, but it still has the same, like, vibe. But I think it would be a Karen movie choice. I do.
Well, the book sounded really good when you were describing it, and I'm interested in that. Like I said, I have, like, 9 of his books here. I may even own it. Who knows? But it sounded good.
All right, awesome. So some of the other things that he did as a screenwriter and director, he wrote and directed Westworld, which was in 1973. He co-wrote Jurassic Park, and he was a co-writer and producer on Twister, which was not a novel. It's just something that he co-wrote as a screenplay.
And I had no idea that he wrote Twister.
I didn't either.
Twister.
Oh, not a clue. So cool.
And Twister's so cool. Like, yeah.
And if anyone is curious as to why Westworld sounds familiar, yes, that is the title of that upcoming HBO series. And yes, it is, this new series is based on that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, like it's a new TV series coming to HBO created by John Nolan. And it's about, let's see, it tells the story of a futuristic theme park called Westworld. And it's like, apparently quite dark, but yeah, if you've seen anything about that, that is actually an adaptation of something that Michael Crichton wrote, and I believe it is like written as a screenplay back in 73, so it was never a book, but it was written to be a screenplay, so this is like an adaptation of the screenplay is what it sounds like. So they're still adapting his stuff. One at a time. Well,
I think in some ways his stuff can be timeless in a way. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. People still like it. Like, people still read his books. It's not like it ever gets really that old. It's not like it's dated in any way.
You know, for four people who have not read a single one of his books before this, we all knew who he was. I mean, that name still means something, and I think that's another reason why people are still adapting his stories.
Exactly. I think that there's something really important about that as well. So moving on to his as a creator. So he created Beyond Westworld, which was, I'm not sure, was it a TV show?
I think so.
I think so, too. And he also created, like we said earlier, he created ER, you guys. Like, I want you to stop and think about this. So ER was, like, one of the most, if not most popular and well, like, most talked about TV show in the mid-90s. It was one of those things that it kind of just took television by storm. Yes, there were medical dramas. There were big, like, medical dramas that everybody really liked. But there was something about ER that was different, and a lot of it was the pacing of the show and the way they did the medical scenes. This was specifically about working in an ER, and Crichton did that during his time studying to be a doctor. And so a lot of it had to do with what it was like to work in an ER. You saw a patient once, you maybe never saw them again. You maybe sent them off to OR and never knew what happened to them. Like, there were so many things about that. And a lot of medical dramas are now structured similar to that. There isn't a lot of follow-up on the patient, and it's not as character-driven as some of the different shows. It was a very in-the-moment show. You're dealing with it in the moment and the repercussions of what that means for those characters. And if you think about the actors that came out of that show, you know what I mean? Yeah. There's some really big-name actors that they weren't really all that well-known until they were on that show. That show is kind of what kind of thrust them into the spotlight. And so it's a really cool thing to think about that that was his. And I was reading, I don't know if you guys looked on his, like, site, but, like, under a television, there's, like, a whole, like, his notes from the ER pilot dailies. Like, he literally would watch the dailies and make notes and send them in. And literally, it's, like, in capital letters, it says, "Don't be afraid to push the pace. The key is the dialogue is to push the pace and throw away the lines. If it feels uncomfortably fast, it's probably about right." And he, like, would go through and just, he made comments like that all the time. So he said, like in a crisis scene, when the pace slows down, the scene loses urgency. "It seemed to me these two seem to have too much time for banter. I don't feel she's hurrying to the next patient." He's talking about very specific scenes when he talks about that. It says, "Push the pace, the proper behavior will naturally flow. Get the actors stepping on each other's lines. Don't be afraid of overlapping." Like, literally, the first, like, eight notes are all about making it faster, making it feel uncomfortable, making it feel like they're talking over each other. And if you think about ER, they did that a lot. Like, it was always, you were, like, sprinting. And as an actor, that's not something I think that they're used to doing or were used to doing at that time. But it is like a rapid fire cadence to what they're doing. And if you work in an ER, that's what your life is like. You don't have time to banter. You don't have time to take it slow and easy. You don't, everything is important. Everything is quick. So I think that it was a really cool way for him to kind of, to be involved in the beginning of ER and to make sure that it felt right to him and that, and that it, you know, it really demonstrated using the medical terms in the talk, which to the normal person watching it, you're not going to know what it means, but you know it's important and it feels like it's serious. So I thought that was really cool, like reading about how he pushed for different things on ER and why he wanted ER to be the way that it was.
Yeah, and if you think about the juggernaut that ER was, I mean, it was on the air for 15 years. Even if those last, like, 5 years were not necessarily as great, like, you know, a lot of people who watched the show stopped somewhere around the 2000 mark or so. But, like, it was on the air for 15 years. It paved the way for shows like Grey's Anatomy and Chicago Med. And, you know, there's a million medical shows now that, you know, if you think about it, like, I think ER was the first to kind of make that the medical field something that could be sustainable. Like, it's easy when you've got, you know, bigger concept story ideas and like bigger stakes to make the stakes super high on other kinds of dramas. But like in a hospital, the stakes are always high. Like everything is, you know, especially in an ER, like you're running around crazy all the time. And like to think that that was doable for 15 years, they continued to make it. It was, the stakes were high enough that they could keep it on the air that long. Like that doesn't happen outside of shows, serials like Law and Order or, you know, like soap operas. Like you don't hear the numbers like 15 come around. So it's insane how successful the show was. And yeah, it launched careers of people that, you know, what would we have done without George Clooney and Juliana Margulies? And like, what, you know, what would we have done?
And Noah Wiley.
Yep.
And I'm going to forget her name, but she plays River Song.
Alex Kingston.
Alex Kingston. She was on that show. Like, there were so many people. When you go back and look at the people who started on ER, and then, you know, everyone went their own ways eventually. But when you kind of get there, you're like, oh my gosh, that was one of those really big shows that just had a lot of people in it that went on to do really amazing things. There was just a lot of things in that show that were so cool and so different. And so and some of them were traumatizing. The one episode I distinctly remember of ER is, I think Kelly Martin was playing an intern and she was working under Noah Wiley, and something happened. They had like a crazy person in there and he got loose and he stabbed them both.
It's the Valentine's Day episode.
Yeah. Like I remember that episode to this day. That's the one I remember because it was horrifying to think about. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was just terrible and like, scary. And so, yeah, that's the one that I remember other things about it, but that particular one stands out to me in a lot of ways. So
yeah, and it was also, like, the doctors were also, like, you were, the fast pace was there, and you cared about the cases, and all of the medical jargon was there, and everything was real. But then you had these characters who, like, you wanted to go home with at the end of their shift because you wanted to know what their lives were like. Like, Dr. Green, spoiler alert for like 15 years ago, his death still bothers me. Like I see like Anthony Edwards in something else and I'm like, oh, doctor, like my heart hurts. Like, cause Dr. Green is one of my favorite characters on TV. And I think like this show, I mean, Staying Elsewhere really paved the way for ER, and then ER paved the way for everything else. But
yeah. And there was Chicago Hope was on at the same time.
Yeah. Chicago Hope was also on.
Right before ER.
Yep.
So they kind of had this overlapping, but there was just something different about ER. Even compared to those other two, it was so drastically different. I'm sorry, go ahead, though.
No, you're absolutely right. It was very different, and I think a lot of it was the character building, like when Noah Wiley left and then like when Carter came back, it was a big deal. Like you just waited for those moments, and I didn't watch it live. I watched it like on TNT reruns in the summers that I spent home. It was on from like 11 to 1. And that was my, I was like, it was like me being like a 13-year-old who had a soap opera afternoon. So I'm like, I can't miss my stories. I have to watch ER. And I was obsessed with ER. Like my whole day would be ruined if like, they're like, oh, we're going to do something. It's the summer. Like we're not going to be home. And I'm like, but will we have TNT from 11 to 1 wherever we're going because I need to watch ER. And then finally, like, I rented them from my library because they had DVDs. And I was like, I need to finish ER. So this was, like, my first, like, real binge show, too. And it's so good. And I will fight the good fight until it is streaming somewhere because I just don't want to buy the box set DVDs.
I know.
But I'm getting closer and closer to pulling the trigger and buying the box set DVDs because I really want to start watching it again.
Yeah.
I have to say that this show, like, as a legacy, it was something that I watched, like, as a kid or, like, a young, like, not quite a teenager, but around that age. And I honestly don't really remember it. I remember glimpses. I remember some characters. But I remember enjoying it, even being young and not really understanding what was going on, because it was sort of the thing that your mom, like, turned on that was in the background. I never got obsessed with it, but I know I've seen a bunch of episodes. And, Brittany, you were just talking about Dr. Green. And I was like, that sounds familiar. I wonder if that's the guy. And I looked it up, and yes, that's the guy. I loved him. His death, like, destroyed me. Even as a kid, even as somebody who hadn't been invested in the show as a whole. And I think that's really interesting, and it's a credence to the way that he's created these characters and just the show in general. And I think, you know, if you can do that, and if you can make that sort of lasting impact, I mean, that's like every writer's dream, is to have characters that people remember decades after they've watched their, you know, one episode or read that book. So it's pretty amazing the things that Michael Crichton has done.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at his website, and this is a comment he has about kind of starting the project with ER. It says, this project has a long history, and it was something that interested me ever since my medical training. What actually happened was in, I think, 89, Steven Spielberg called me up and said he wanted to do a project about an emergency room, and I said I did too. We began to work on this thing, and shortly after that, he got interested in dinosaurs, and I did too. So we deferred this thing, and it kept getting deferred, and it finally seemed as though it was not going to have a life in the way that we had originally imagined. And we thought of doing it as a television show, which we're glad we did. So, you know, when your buddy Steven Spielberg just calls you up and is like, hey, there's this thing I was thinking about. Do you think you could write it? And then, oh, by the way, you know what? That thing we're going to put over here, because there's this other thing that has really cool dinosaurs in it. I think we should do that first. I mean, how crazy? I don't know. So the man created a lot of modern day things, I think, even though, you know, there may have been issues with his writing and things weren't always the same. But I think a lot of the material that he came up with and a lot of things that he wrote about and the way things were crafted, like ER, have set a big precedent and a big tone for the way some of these novels and television shows and things are developed to this day. All right, so let's quickly just review what Dragon Teeth is about, because that will be the next novel and probably the last novel, unless there's another secret stash of files somewhere, from Michael Crichton. So it was recently discovered. It will be published by HarperCollins in May 2017. And so the novel is about, it's a true story. If you guys remember, we talked a little bit about this. It's based on a rivalry between two real-life paleontologists, Edward Drinker Cope and Othniel Charles Marsh, during a time of intense fossil speculation and discovery in the American West in 1878. The story unfolds through the adventures of a young fictional character named William Johnson, who was apprenticed first to one and then the other, and not only makes discoveries of historic proportion, but transforms into an aspiring hero only Crichton could have imagined. So a lot of this is based on research, and it's basically based on this time that was called the Bone Wars, and it's the golden age of American fossil hunting. So it's kind of like this thrilling story of the Wild West in hunting for fossils. So I think it'll be really interesting, and I love that it's based on a real time and on a real thing and on real people. Like, I think that's so cool. I love when books do that. Even though it may twist it and make it a little different, and it's not the, you know, the actual story, or it deviates from the reality of the story. I love when the stories are connected that way.
I have to say, I'm a little curious as to whether in this real life, you know, set in reality story, if there's going to be dragons, like if they're going to find dragon bones in addition to dinosaur bones. Like, I want to know what the adventure part of all this is. Like, why did he call it Dragon Teeth? Why, you know, if it's set in this very specific historical period and with these incredibly real, you know, absolutely real paleontologists, like, with all of that, there's always an element of, like, fantastic, you know, fantasy craziness to his story. So I'm kind of curious where that comes in this one. So, should be cool.
Absolutely. I think it'll be interesting. Do you guys have any other speculation about this title?
Not so much about the title, but I do think I'll definitely read it, because, like, if reading this one book and just listening to what you guys were saying with all of the books that you guys picked up, I am interested to read more of his work and see how things could be adapted or see what this holds, because, like, Jurassic Park was just so cool, like, seeing it and reading this novel that led into ER was just really awesome. And, you know, like Karen was saying last week before we started this, you know, you can get his books for like 25 cents at any garage sale. So they're not like hard to come by. And I feel like I should start paying more attention to them.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. It's like, I've known who Michael Crichton is for years and years and years, but I just never got around to reading any of his stuff. And I had seen Jurassic Park, but that was pretty much where my specific knowledge ended. And now I'm really interested in just getting to know what he's done, because Krista and I were talking and she was like, you know, he's done such a vast majority of genres. He's written about so many different things, but the quality of his work stays the same. I mean, all that research that goes into it is just phenomenal. And you have to wonder, you know, how smart was this guy? Because he just dove in as deeply as possible and came up with these stories. And it's pretty incredible. And I'm just throwing it out there that maybe come next May, we can do a Dragon Teeth review, because by that time, maybe we'll have picked up more of his things and kind of know his writing a bit better. And I think it would be interesting to kind of come back and discuss him as a writer, but also this new book, and kind of compare it to what we've known about his older things.
Yeah, his work is dramatically different from the kind of things that I normally read. I mean, let's face it. And so it was hard for me to get into it. But once I got involved, like, I fell just, you know, fell into the story just as easily as you do Jurassic Park or any of the other things. Like, it's really easy to get wrapped up in his creations, even if it's not your typical fare. So if you've never read a Michael Crichton book, give it a shot. Pick one, you know. Take a glance at all of the synopses. I'm sure there are a couple that you have not heard of, as I discovered when looking at his, you know, his publishing list. It's like, wow, there are some of these I didn't know existed. You know, give it a try to, you know, test one out and see if you can be pulled into it, you know, a whole new genre that you don't usually read.
Okay. So up next for us, you guys, we're going to discuss The Cursed Child, which some of us have read, some of us, and Brittany was lucky enough to see the play, so she can compare reading it versus seeing it. But we will be discussing that next episode, which will be really interesting because there's so many mixed reviews about it out there. So if you guys have any questions or thoughts on that, please make sure to tweet us and we will include them in that episode. So until next time, I'm Jen.
I'm Brittany.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Kristen.
Goodbye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Jen. Welcome to Book Hype. That's terrible. We're going to start that again because I have no idea what I'm saying.